It has significant range constraints within the Mediterranean. And one of the better places to test is in Alaska.
Israeli missile interceptors will be tested in Kodiak. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, managers of the Alaska Permanent Fund are planning for an uncertain future.
We're holding probably more cash than we otherwise would at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Israel is working on a better missile to counter the threat of an Iranian launch. But Israel lives in a crowded neighborhood, so the plan is to test the interceptor in Kodiak. That's the word from Admiral James Searing, head of the U.S. Missile Defense Agency. Searing told a U.S. House committee today that the U.S. is Israel's partner in developing that country's missile defense system, particularly Israel's Arrow 3 missile.
It has significant range constraints within the Mediterranean. And one of the better places to test is in Alaska from Kodiak, and we plan to do that next year.
Craig Campbell, CEO of the state-owned Alaska Aerospace Corporation, says the deal isn't final yet.
The Missile Defense Agency, MDA, has approached us about doing the Israeli program out of Kodiak, and we are in the process of negotiating that contract with them today.
The work would be a component of the $80 million contract MDA and the Alaska Aerospace Corporation announced a year ago. Also, under that umbrella contract, Campbell says MDA plans to launch missiles from the Kodiak Island facility sometime in the next few weeks or months.
The test we have for THAAD, that's the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense Program, that's going to be a series of tests coming up this summer. The dates are classified. But prior to the launches, there'll be public notice given as to when the launch is going to occur. But there will be two launches this summer.
The Missile Defense Agency conducted a successful test over the Pacific 2 weeks ago. Admiral Searing says it was set up to replicate the scenario of a North Korean launch at the U.S. But for the test, everything was moved a few thousand miles south, so the interceptor was launched from California instead of Alaska's Fort Greely. Uncertainty over how the legislature will close the state's budget gap is affecting the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. The corporation is investing more conservatively, so it has cash on hand in case the legislature uses fund earnings to close the gap. Alaska Public Media's Andrew Kitchenman talked with Permanent Fund head Angela Rodell about the uncertainty.
How much money the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation keeps close at hand is usually pretty straightforward. For 35 years, money from fund earnings have gone to two places. One is the Permanent Fund Dividend Fund, the money from which residents' annual dividend checks are drawn. The other is the main body of the Permanent Fund, where earnings are reinvested. This year, both legislative chambers have passed a bill that would use the earnings for a new purpose, to pay for state government. Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Angela Rodell and other fund managers are preparing to pay more out of the earnings than they ever have. But they still don't know how much that will be, so they have to keep more money in investments that are quickly accessed.
We are focused on the liquidity requirement that we will have to send over a significant amount of cash.
The House has proposed drawing more than $4 billion in the next year, more than $1.5 billion more than the Senate.
As income comes in, rather than investing it into the long-term asset allocation, we're holding probably more cash than we otherwise would at this point in anticipation that the draw amount might be bigger than the Senate version.
Rodell uses cash as a figure of speech. There aren't neatly stacked bills in a bank vault. The fund invests the money it may withdraw, but it does so in conservative assets like treasury bills. That means the fund will likely earn slightly less money than it would if it invested all of the money to maximize earnings. Rodell says the state would benefit if any draw from the fund is based on a predictable plan, similar to what was included in both the Senate and House versions of the permanent fund legislation.
Part of my concern will be if that doesn't pass, sort of the unknown quality of how much money they're going to use, because under the current construct, they're allowed to take and to appropriate as much as they need out of the earnings reserve account.
Lawmakers have reached a stalemate over which version of the permanent fund bill, Senate Bill 26, will become law. Rodell is hopeful they'll be able to resolve their differences.
We just want to know how much to write the check for to send over to the state treasury. And we are trying to balance that out. And having a difference of $1.6 billion is a big difference. And we're hopeful that they can get that reconciled sooner rather than later.
Rodell notes the corporation went through something similar last year when the Senate passed a bill to draw money from the fund, only to have it die in the House. Governor Bill Walker then vetoed half the permanent fund dividend money, the first time that has ever happened.
We've been having this uncertainty of both bigger than anticipated draws and maybe smaller than anticipated draws now for the 2 years. So that's why I'm hopeful that we are able to get back to a more rules-based strategy like we've had in the past going forward.
The legislature has until the end of the month to pass a budget to avoid a government shutdown. The special session is scheduled to end on June 16th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Copper River king salmon return is coming in better than forecast, predicted to be the weakest on record at about 29,000 kings. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Upper Copper River management biologist Mark Somerville says the forecast is being questioned given recent weeks' king harvest by commercial fishers on the river's delta.
Even under restricted area and time, the commercial fishery has caught over 8,000 king salmon, which is unexpected, and indicates that the return may be higher than we anticipated.
Somerville says the better-than-expected commercial king harvest is supported by data from a mark and recapture project. The information has resulted in the state beginning to peel back sport and subsistence king harvest restrictions.
We have rescinded the limits in the subsistence fishery so that there is currently no limit on king salmon for fish wheels, and we are back to the 5-fish limit for dip netting in the subsistence fishery. We have also reopened the sport fishery to an annual limit of 2 king salmon, with only 1 allowed from each tributary, and we've allowed the use of bait in selected waters, say the Clutina, Tonsina, and portions of the Gulkana River.
Somerville says the state has delayed easing a king harvest ban in the personal use dipnet fishery at Chitna because of remaining uncertainty about the strength of the run and the fishery's popularity.
Off about a week or so because that fishery is a very powerful fishery and can harvest upwards of 1,000 king salmon in a week.
Somerville says if it continues to appear the king run is better than forecast and escapement can be met, the state will open the personal use dip net fishery at Chitna to limited king catch. The personal use fishery opened this morning for sockeye harvest. The Copper River sockeye return is forecast to come in at about 1.8 million fish, a slightly below average return. Officials in Anchorage may begin looking at a fuel tax as a way to raise revenue for essential services like policing and infrastructure. Though there's no official proposal on the table at this point, today an advisory commission on the budget heard a presentation on what a potential fuel tax could look like. Compared to every other state in the nation, Alaska has by far the lowest taxes on gasoline, though local sales taxes and complicated logistics make the price per gallon vary widely. In his presentation to the commission, the city's treasurer, Dan Moore, gave multiple figures for how much revenue could be generated by different tax amounts on a gallon of gasoline. A 10% tax would mean around $14 million in revenues. At 18 cents a gallon, around $25 million is forecasted to come in. That captures local drivers as well as commuters from the Mat-Su Valley and seasonal tourists. The commission may advise the assembly to look at a fuel tax when they take the issue back up. If the proposal takes the form of an excise tax, the Assembly could pass it with a simple majority. As it would still fall under the city's tax cap, any revenue generated would likely supplement property taxes. If a proposal calls for a sales tax, it would need to go before voters in an election. A new labor contract between the City of Anchorage and the union representing firefighters could lead to savings for taxpayers. A collaborative deal was reached between the municipality and the local chapter of the International Association of Firefighters, whose members voted in favor of the contract in May. It's a proactive move that set out new terms almost a year before the current contract was set to expire. If members of the Anchorage Assembly approve the agreement, firefighters will see just one pay raise of 1.5% in the next 3 years. That's a change from the yearly wage increases under the last contract. The municipality will, however, increase its benefit contribution by more than $500 every month per employee by 2020. According to the city's Office of Management and Budget Director, the contract will save the city $2.3 million over the next 3 years. The municipality has had to close budget gaps in recent years through increased property taxes as income sources and the state's revenue sharing to local governments have declined. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 750-mile race up the Inside Passage to Ketchikan on a paddleboard.
We don't want to die. I mean, of course, what we are doing is a little nutty, but no, we're not looking at dying.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Two longtime board members of Juneau's Urban Alaska Native Corporation have been ousted through elections at an annual shareholder meeting held on Saturday. Gold Belt Incorporated announced Monday that Lori Grant and Leilani Wilson-Walkush will replace Joseph Coughlin and Brandy Wanamaker on the nine-member board. A third member up for re-election, Andrea Cadiente Leite, retained her board seat. Randy Wanamaker had served on the board for 24 years. He says he thinks the election results reflected confusion among shareholders about the company's finances and cultural contributions.
Some of the candidates were talking about how Gold Belt is losing money and is not profitable, and that's highly inaccurate. Gold Belt is not unprofitable. It's very successful in shareholder hire and support for culture and scholarship programs. And somehow I think people tuned into the inaccurate message.
The company's annual reports in recent years do show the company has been profitable and contributes to the programs Wanamaker referred to. Over the years, Wanamaker and other outgoing board member Joseph Coughlin were party to the creation of the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and several shareholder programs offering scholarships, internships, and even managers training. In fact, one of the new board members, Leilani Wilson-Walkush, cited her experience decades ago as a Gold Belt intern as part of why she ran.
1995, so I guess technically 22 years ago.
She says she wants to bring back to Gold Belt some of the skills and experiences she's had since then. Outgoing board chairman Joseph Coughlin also has a long history with Gold Belt. He was its first CEO when it was incorporated in 1972 and has served 35 years on the board. The new board reorganized after the election and selected Ben Coronel as the new chairman. In a news release, Coronel said Gold Belt continues to grow despite uncertainty in the federal, state, and local budgets and a down economy. He said while most of the company's revenue comes from government contracting, it is exploring new business. The company has more than 3,700 shareholders. The director of the Indian Health Service is scheduled to visit interior villages tomorrow. IHS Director Chris Buchanan plans to tour Rampart and Allakaket with a group of state and regional Native leaders. Charlotte Mayo is a tribal workforce development specialist with the Allakaket Village Council. Mayo says the Koyukuk River community will highlight essential infrastructure needs.
We really need running water. We're one of the last villages to get running water. We have a lot of elders that are can't leave their houses, and we have we really need running water.
Mayo says the village currently gets its water from a washateria, but it only has 3 showers and 2 washing machines. Mayo says the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is targeting a pilot project that will bring water and sewer to a limited number of homes in Allakaket. She says it could range from 3 to 21 homes, depending on funding. About 180 people live in Allakaket and across the river in the village of Alotna, and Mayo says residents are getting ready to welcome the IHS director and accompanying officials.
Cleaning up all over the place just so it'll look nice, and getting all the native foods ready. Moose soup, fish.
Secretary Buchanan's group is scheduled to visit the Yukon River village of Rampart to see water and clinic facilities and meet with local leaders. The Bristol Bay Borough has agreed to incentivize investments into refrigerated seawater, known as RSW, or onboard chilling systems for area fishing boats. The Bristol Bay Assembly voted to offer a $1,500 fish tax rebate to drift boat skippers who are making the costly upgrade. As seafood processors continue to pay more for chilled salmon, the borough recognized that its future tax revenues should go up alongside the value of the catch. KDLG's Nick Schlino reports.
The Bristol Bay Drift Fleet sold more chilled salmon than ever before to processors last year, but some vessels are still not equipped with RSW chilling systems. On Monday, the Bristol Bay Borough Assembly voted in favor of enacting an incentive for those who still have yet to make the upgrade.
It's a way to put a little money back into the fisherman's pocket, help improve or give incentive to improve the quality of salmon caught in Bristol Bay.
That's borough manager John Fulton. He says effective from January 1st of 2017 until the end of 2018, fishermen with proof of purchase of an RSW system will get a one-time rebate from their fish tax.
They'd have to prove to the borough that they had made these purchases, so invoices, receipts. Then the borough would issue a voucher, and then the fishermen could turn this voucher over to their processor. And so the first $1,500, or up to the first $1,500, depending on how much they fish, of their 3% borough tax would be paid to them instead of to the borough.
Mary Swain wrote the ordinance change. She was approached in Anchorage this summer by Bristol Bay skipper Buck Gibbons, who helped spearhead the plan. Swain says the incentive is a good deal for both fishermen and processors and will help add to the overall value of the fishery.
Well, the fishery, of course, is pushing a value-added product, and that's, of course, what we want to see come out of our Bristol Bay Borough waters, is value-added product. So this helps those, and those fishermen that are a little reluctant to go forward and put the RSW in their boats, that's what this ordinance is for.
The Bristol Bay Borough Assembly voted 3-1 in favor of the measure. Swain says there are plans in the work to add additional incentives for fishermen who already have RSW systems.
That was KDLG's Nick Schlino reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
If you're one of the 120,000 Alaskans with some college but no degree, the Finnish College Alaska Initiative at the University of Alaska Southeast offers a degree program with flexible online learning and a personalized degree plan. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Honeybees aren't native to Alaska, but 4 beekeepers are making an experiment of keeping hives in Dillingham. That's something that's been done before, but infrequently. As KDLG's Avery Lill reports, they're hoping to expand their operations beyond the summer, wintering their bees over, and that is something new.
There's some gloves. These are cow skin, so we can't sting through them. Pamela Murphy dons a classic white bee suit, making sure all the zippers are zipped, the Velcro is fastened, and the elastic cuffs are pulled down well over her extra tufts. Then she slides on her calfskin gloves. She's had her bees for about 2 weeks, and she hasn't been stung yet. Murphy's bee box sits in a sunny clearing. Several bees meander toward a small opening in the wooden crate that's about the size of a microwave. The pollen baskets on their hind legs are swollen and bright yellow. Murphy opens the lid to reveal the 9 trays that fill the box. She lifts one up. It's teeming with bees that are beginning to build a honeycomb.
The bees are mostly working on creating the wax comb to have all this space to store honey. And then ultimately, come late August, early September, we'll take the frames out of the honey supers and try to extract what honey we have. And then the ultimate goal is to then take these bees, insulate the hive, and try to winter them over.
That's an unusual goal for beekeepers in Alaska. Honeybees need temperatures above 50 degrees to fly. They need to fly to defecate, and if they don't, they'll become septic and die. So most Alaska beekeepers kill their bees when the temperatures plunge and start over with a new colony in the spring. But Murphy has a strategy, and Bristol Bay's temperatures are mild enough relative to the rest of Alaska that it just might work.
Bees do go into a kind of a hibernation state. We'll put everything into one brood box, so we won't extract all their honey. We want them to keep what they need to survive the winter. We'll insulate, I guess the brood box, we'll insulate it. So we'll hopefully do maybe some controlled climate, maybe put something over them to warm it up so they can get out at least one time in the winter to go to the bathroom.
This beekeeping project began with a February class at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Bristol Bay campus. Don Kogan, a master beekeeper from Fairbanks, taught a weekend crash course in Dillingham. Afterward, 4 people, counting Murphy, decided to make a go of it and order their own bees. Turns out, even getting bees to rural Alaska can be a chore. Some bees got loose in the cargo hold when the first vendor tried to ship Murphy's bees, and the airline refused to carry that vendor's goods. The second vendor was more successful at keeping the critters contained. Her roughly 20,000 Carniolan bees arrived from California a couple weeks ago. Murphy is in this for more than the honey. Her hive is so new, she'll probably only get a jar or two this year. It's really about the science.
Part of the hive that I have is working with the Bristol Bay campus and working with Don Kogan to basically do the research and find out, can we winter bees over? What does it take to winter bees over? And between myself and the other 3 beekeepers, we will gain enough information to be able to, you know, do it again and again and again, and then give that information to Don Kogan, who can then put it into her work and basically have a set of standards in beekeeping in Dillingham, Alaska.
Between the bees and the equipment, Murphy has about $600 invested in her hive. If the bees don't survive the winter, it will be a little over $200 to order more next year. But if the experiment is a success, this will be the first time bees have been successfully wintered over in Dillingham. As she replaces the top of her bee box, Murphy uses a brush to gently sweep the bees away from the edges, trying not to squish any.
Bear with me 1 second, just make sure my top is on good.
With that gentle care, Murphy and the small community of Dillingham beekeepers she calls a bee club hope to make a hospitable home in a harsh climate for Dillingham's new buzzy residents. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The starting gun fires tomorrow for the 3rd edition of a zany Pacific Northwest boating contest. The Race to Alaska sends sailors, rowers, and paddlers from Port Townsend, Washington, on a 750-mile marathon up the Inside Passage to Ketchikan. This year, 3 competitors will race on stand-up paddleboards. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi asks, why?
There's some really big water between here and Alaska.
Oh, yes.
And the paddleboard is not very protected. Can it be done safely?
Yeah, I definitely feel that it can be done safely.
That's paddleboarder Erdogan Kirak of Bellingham, Washington. He entered the Race to Alaska on the urging of his friend Luke Burritt. They plan to paddle together the whole way on separate 17.5-foot boards.
We don't want to die. I mean, of course, what we are doing is a little nutty, but no, we're not looking at dying.
Burritt says he was inspired to try something no one has achieved before on a paddleboard.
My life kind of is adventure. I've immersed myself in it. Climbing guide and paddleboard instructor, mm-hmm. who lives in a van. That is what I do. I kind of live for being outdoors and the adventure.
The Race to Alaska has 2 basic rules: no motors and no support crews. A race co-founder once compared the Maritime Marathon to the Iditarod sled dog race, but with a chance of drowning or being eaten by a bear or run over by a freighter. The custom-built paddleboards Burritt and Curac will stand aboard look like surfboards that have been stretched.
Like I said, we've got 28 tie-downs over the entire thing, but this is our main tie-down location for our forward gear.
Their ultralight gear includes dry suits, water filter, mosquito-proof hammocks, pepper spray, and 3 to 4 days of food at a time.
We're also planning on trying to do as much scavenging and foraging as we can.
For seaweed or shellfish to eat. One of the places they trained was in the heavy swells on the Columbia River in the gorge near Hood River, Oregon.
You're paddling, 50 feet from your buddy, and all of a sudden you're like, where'd he go? Because one of the swells didn't swallow him up, but is too tall and you just can't see over it. And it's super fun to go do something like that. And you have the right equipment on, so you do feel safe.
Curac declined to estimate a race finish time other than to say the team aims to average about 35 miles per day. That means they're not in it for the $10,000 top prize or the second place award of a set of steak knives. There is a third paddleboarder entered in the race. Carl Kruger of Orcas Island, Washington, is making his second solo attempt at the race to Alaska. He dropped out after 100 miles last year due to cracks in his board. Kruger now has a new custom racing expedition board. He plans to sustain himself mainly on high-calorie food pellets, along with some protein shakes and energy bars and gels. Race to Alaska co-founder Jake Beattie says the organizers carefully vetted the stand-up paddleboarders and other even smaller craft in the race.
Generally, we have a high degree of skepticism around paddleboarders. In fact, when we were starting this race 3 years ago, we looked at each other and said, well, one thing's for sure, we're never going to let a paddleboard into the race. And this year, of course, we let three in.
Paddleboarding is a fast-growing sport here in the Northwest and worldwide, and long-distance races are multiplying too. 11 paddleboarders entered last summer's Yukon River Quest race from Whitehorse to Dawson, and 9 of those finished the 444-mile downriver journey. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Andrew Kitchenman and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Avery Lill and Nick Schlino in Dillingham, Tom Bonsi in Port Townsend, Washington, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.